On the Capitol Press Room, we recently highlighted the state's effort to provide temporary housing to homeless New Yorkers broadly, and now we're going to zero in on the effort to shelter and provide services to homeless New Yorkers with a mental illness and consider whether the existing safety net is working. To do all that, we're joined by Crain's New York healthcare reporter Maya Kaufman, who recently did a deep dive into this issue with her piece, Fatal Neglect. Welcome back to the show, Maya.
Great to be here.
So first off, I think to lay down sort of a base, is it common for homeless New Yorkers to have a mental illness, or is it simply the case that homeless New Yorkers with a mental illness are more visible?
It's really that they are disproportionately visible. There are not too many statistics on the prevalence of mental illness in this population of people who are experiencing homelessness, but some estimates put it at about 1 in 6. And if we're talking about New York City, for example, there's about 250,000 adults with a serious mental illness, about 3% of the total population. So the prevalence is a little bit higher when we're specifically talking about the homeless population, but it's far from the majority.
And when you say something like a serious mental illness, can you put that into context for us? What does that mean in terms of a person's, you know, ability to basically support themselves and, I guess, function in society?
Serious mental illness refers to any case when a mental health condition substantially interferes with someone's daily living. So it doesn't refer to a specific diagnosis. It's really about how much it affects that person's daily life.
So then turning to the services and supports that the state is supposed to provide homeless New Yorkers with a mental illness, what is that safety net supposed to look like? How is it supposed to operate in theory?
There are a number of programs. First of all, homeless shelters have, in some cases, mental health services on site. So that might be a psychiatrist who specifically works with that shelter's population, although not all shelters have that same level of resources. And then there are also a number of programs specifically for New Yorkers who face serious mental illness. And those are assertive community treatment and intensive mobile treatment, which are basically teams of a lot of providers who work together to help someone who has serious mental illness. And that doesn't have to be someone who's homeless, but we often find that homeless New Yorkers, whether they're living in shelters or on the streets, will get help from one of these programs. IMT, or intensive mobile treatment, is a city-specific program. And that one is specifically designed to be more flexible to help people who are street homeless.
And is there reason to believe that these services are effective?
They certainly are effective for a lot of people, but that comes with a lot of caveats. First of all, there are incredibly long waiting lists to get onto these programs because there's a limited number of slots. As I've reported, the waiting list right now in New York City, it's more than 600 people as of earlier this month waiting for a spot on an assertive community treatment team, and then well over 100 waiting for an intensive mobile treatment team. And so as a result of that, and due to a number of other factors, you'll often see people cycling in and out of hospital emergency rooms, sometimes state psychiatric hospitals, and all of these other venues of care that we have set up because there's such limited access to these resources. And when they work well, they can work well, but it really depends on the person. We've certainly seen cases where it doesn't appear that outpatient services, meaning something that's in the community versus at a hospital, are not always effective for people depending on their specific needs, diagnoses, how they respond to medication. And so a lot of the people I interviewed said these are great programs, but it's not one size fits all.
And what are the ramifications when someone is either put in a program that doesn't necessarily meet all their needs, or they're just denied services completely?
We really see an attitude almost of kind of passing the buck, where if someone isn't really seeing an effect from one of these programs, they're discharged and sent to the next type of provider, or they're really left with little to no access to resources. That's when we see a lot of people turn up at the hospital in a crisis because they're looking for immediate help and they're not really sure where to get it. And in the most extreme circumstances, we see people experience an acute crisis out on the streets. And that's what's happened in the cases that were particularly high profile, with the case of Michelle Goh earlier this year, and then back in 1999, the case of Kendra Webdale. Both of those women were pushed in front of subway trains by someone who had a long history of serious mental illness and struggled to access the care that was available.
Well, yeah, and I want to touch on the policy response to that 1999 incident. But first, let me reintroduce you to our guests. We're speaking with Maya Kaufman. She's a healthcare reporter for Cranes New York. And in response to that tragedy more than 20 years ago, state policymakers adopted Kendra's Law, which, for lack of any nuance, can basically force mentally ill New Yorkers into treatment. And it was something that was revisited in the state budget this past year. So when we look back on the implementation of this law for 20 plus years, which has been a key tool in addressing mental illness and theoretically keeping people safe, does the history seem to indicate that it is effective in those two goals?
That'll depend on who you talk to. And I do want to clarify that the law isn't exactly forcing people into treatment. It's putting them under a court order that says if they're not compliant with a treatment plan, that they could potentially be hospitalized involuntarily, but it doesn't necessarily guarantee them access to mental health care services. So, of course, that's one of the issues. And we do see also a number of people lapse from these court orders because of delays in the court systems or failure to renew them. A number of instances, there certainly are advocates who say the data from the program shows that it's been really effective for people who have been in it in terms of outcomes, whether they're able to retain housing and things like that. But we also see that there are people who never make it onto a court order, or maybe were once under one of these court orders and it lapsed for whatever reason. That's actually the case in the example of Marshall Simon, who is the man who was arrested in connection with Michelle Goh's death earlier this year. He was once under an order under Kendra's Law, or assisted outpatient treatment, or AOT, but it lapsed and we're not exactly sure why, but he was under it and it ended.
So as we think about big picture solutions to this issue, is the answer, like many things in state government and municipal government, just a question of resources and time to implement those resources? Or from talking to people who live and breathe this issue, are there policy changes that could be made in the interim that could have a significant short-term benefit?
Yeah, I asked pretty much everyone that I interviewed for this story, well over 50 people, about their suggestions for actionable solutions to this crisis. And of course, people will say more resources is always a great thing, but we also see issues in how those resources are allocated. For example, the state just devoted millions more in funding to create new assertive community treatment teams. Right now, those teams have a statewide capacity of about 8,000. But providers said, well, the funding per team was actually below what they usually spend on the team. So if the state had tweaked that number a little bit, it would have been more effective, is what the nonprofits that run these teams say. So a lot of it is a question of the exact numbers and how those things are allocated. Not so much just let's pour more money into this, although of course that's something that you'll hear most everyone ask for.
And when you talk to people who are in this field, do they convey that they're optimistic in any way, shape, or form about the future, or are they pessimistic?
It really depends who you talk to, but I spoke to a fair number of people who said basically our system is just not going to produce the outcomes that we want unless we fundamentally reshape it and totally reform it, and that it's fundamentally broken. I heard that a number of times, and that is reflected in the article. And part of it is a symptom of larger issues we see in healthcare, where how healthcare is paid for, the reliance on insurance, you know, the shortage of healthcare providers that we're seeing nationwide across fields. So there are larger issues here, but there certainly are some calls to try and fundamentally reshape this and have more coordination, take a look at the programs that we have and see where we can fill the gaps, create more slots in all of these programs. Increased pay for providers is a huge one that a lot of nonprofits will talk about, and really focus on this population if this is something that we're concerned about. And one thing that I heard a fair amount is that in some ways doesn't seem to be a real commitment reflected in the funding and the resources to actually improving outcomes for this population. There's a fair amount of pessimism from some providers that some people just really don't care, but these are New Yorkers who need help.
Well, finally, where do you want to go next with this reporting? Is there a follow-up that you have in mind?
Ultimately, this all points to the need for more housing too, since housing is linked to better health outcomes and is seen as a social determinant of health, basically a social outcome in someone's health that relates to someone's health status. And so one of the issues that we didn't explore as much in this piece is the role of supportive housing, which are buildings that have on-site services, but have been critiqued because the level of services isn't always adequate for people who have serious mental illness, or folks who have serious mental illness may not always be accepted to these kinds of units because they're told that they need more care than those units can provide. So that seems to be a big gap that we currently face in New York, and is something that I know a lot of advocates are talking about, and there's certainly a lot more room to explore that.
Well, we've been speaking with Maya Kaufman. She's a healthcare reporter for Cranes New York. Maya, thank you so much for making the time, and congrats on the piece.
Thanks so much.
And for more of our coverage on issues facing homeless New Yorkers, as well as New Yorkers with mental illnesses, visit capitalpressroom.org or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Support for the Capital Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
Join us again for Capital Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.